good morning to you all. You are listening to People Rise Up here on your community-supported radio station, KBOO. It's a couple minutes after 10, and as with most things talked about on this program, the idea that the people are the only ones who are going to get anything done holds very much true today. We've got something, two different things, actually, that we're going to want you to do today. And both of them are really very simple. We're going to be talking today about legal actions. And I'm not sure if this is, I didn't get a chance to contact a presidential historian like I wanted to before talking today, to find out if there's been a time in history where in the same week, the occupier of the office of president of the United States and a cabinet official were both indicted in the same week in two different countries related to the same crimes, and these being war crimes. And specifically, I'm talking about George W. Bush, who was indicted earlier this week, or requested to be indicted earlier this week in Canada, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who was indicted in Germany for war crimes. All of this related to the torture and abuse scandals at the Abu Ghraib prison outside of Baghdad in Iraq, Guantanamo Bay down in Cuba, and at least with the Rumsfeld case in Germany, several dozen possibly secret CIA locations around the world where torture is also alleged to have taken place. Going to go until 11 o'clock this morning, and thanks to Kathleen for the extra time. First, I will be speaking with Gail Davidson. She's co-chair of Lawyers Against the War, a group up in British Columbia who launched the effort regarding George W. Bush. And I'll just take a moment here to welcome you to the airwaves, Gail.
Thank you very much. Hi.
Hi. And we'll talk to Gail for about a half hour or so, and then I will play a recording of an interview I did last evening at 6 p.m. local time with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, all about their case in Germany against Donald Rumsfeld. And as you mentioned yesterday, Gail, you guys are going to be getting involved in that to an extent as well.
That's right.
Well, let's start out by talking about actually just prior to what's the technical legal language in Canada for what you all did? Bush wasn't actually indicted. You're seeking a formal investigation to get charges brought in Canada.
No, he was indicted. We did lay criminal charges against him for torture. We laid seven charges against him. And why we were able to do that is under the Criminal Code of Canada, you can lay, it has an expanded jurisdiction for torture, and we were able to lay the information because Bush was in Canada. And so we laid it on November the 30th, the day that he arrived. Now, the charges were properly laid, and of course they were, for a private person to lay criminal charges in Canada, the private person has to have reasonable grounds. Okay, so naturally we had reasonable grounds. The torture charges are backed up with an overwhelming amount of evidence that torture was taking place, and a similarly overwhelming amount of evidence that Bush knew about it and, in fact, devised the policies of intentional lawlessness that gave rise to the torture, and you can say even necessitated the use of torture techniques in an attempt to extract information from detainees. So that was all done on November the 30th. And then what has to happen when a private person lays in information, and this is just a proper balance check to make sure that private people don't go and lay frivolous and vexatious information. Mm-hmm. There's then a hearing held before either a judge or a justice of the peace to review the reasonableness of the grounds.
And that took place Monday.
That was what usually happens when a private person lays a prosecution is that review is automatically set up. So, for instance, when I laid the information on the Tuesday, November the 30th, I had all my briefs, my torture briefs, with me and asked the Justice of the Peace if he'd like me to review them, and that wasn't necessary for him. And I just swore to the matter, and perhaps the Justice of the Peace didn't feel he had to look at my briefs because I'm a lawyer and I was swearing to the fact that I had reasonable grounds. In any event, when I came to, so on Monday, what we were supposed to be doing is fixing a date for that process hearing. It's called a process hearing because the judge reviews the reasonable grounds, and if there are reasonable grounds, then the judge has to decide what process to issue. So the two types, the judge would either issue an arrest warrant or an appearance notice. And what happened, see, on these criminal charges, the Attorney General has 8 days within which to consent. And we were taking the position that the Attorney General shouldn't exercise his consent or no consent until he'd reviewed the reasonable grounds, because he's bound to exercise his consent in a judicial manner, not just in an arbitrary manner. And so when we got to court on Monday, what happened is the... it was a bit like falling down the dark hole in Alice in Wonderland. The judge ordered the courtroom sealed, and so everybody was excluded except for the courtroom personnel and myself and the government's lawyer and the judge. And then after a very short series of goings back and forth, the judge declared that the information was a nullity. So in other words, that it didn't exist and it had never existed. Again, I felt a little bit like maybe we had dropped into the Queen of Hearts
situation. Wait a minute. What information didn't exist?
The information is what we call the indictment.
Right. It's in here. It's right in front of me here. So the indictment
was a nullity.
Didn't exist.
Yes, it was a nullity, and the reason what given by the judge for it being a nullity was that the Justice of the Peace, who took accepted the information, didn't have any jurisdiction to accept an information charging the President of the United States with torture.
That's not true, though.
Yes, because the President of the United States was protected by diplomatic immunity. Now, unfortunately, that's not true.
No, because I'm actually looking at part of, well, I guess it's the letter that you folks sent, let's see, November 24th to the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, and this is regarding trying to keep Bush out of Canada before he visited Ottawa.
Yes.
About a week and a half back. And I can't find it off the top of my head here, but there was something along the lines of, you know, you can't commit war crimes and crimes against humanity willfully and just be able to claim, oh, I'm the sovereign, it's okay.
Yes, no, obviously not. And torture, you see, is an international crime, and the Pinochet case in England decided that immunity for heads of state didn't extend to the acts of torture that the head of state had committed while a head of state, obviously, because committing torture isn't a legitimate function of a head of state. In any event, Lawyers Against the War had never said that we wanted an arrest warrant issued against Mr. Bush in a hasty manner. We have always said we wanted to slowly and ponderously go through all the legal steps. And one of the legal steps that needs to be gone through after the reasonable grounds hearing had been held is an investigation and discussion and adjudication on the ambit of diplomatic immunity. Diplomatic immunity is not a bar to prosecution. It's only ever a defense. And then it's just a temporary defense anyway. And the issue of how wide that defense is in under Canadian law and under international law is very much up in the air, because as states like the United States, for instance, when it signed the Convention Against Torture in 1994, and Canada when it signed the Convention Against Torture in 87, both in signing the torture took on the responsibility to change their laws so that they could prosecute acts of torture wherever they happened, wherever the victims were and wherever the perpetrators were. And the only thing in Canada that Canada needs to prosecute crimes of torture is that the person be on Canadian soil at the time the information was filed. That's why we filed it here. So it's a very important question to decide how broad is diplomatic immunity. And obviously the decision on Monday was completely wrong, but it seemed to be intentioned to just get rid of the information as something that was embarrassing. But the issue is a terribly important one, because torture is a crime of the state. You know, torture is a crime that is committed. Do you know what the three elements of torture are? Do you think I should say that for your listeners?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so first of all, it's the intentional infliction of physical or mental pain. The second thing is for a purpose. The pain is inflicted for a purpose, for example, to extract information. The third thing is it is inflicted under the direction, with the consent, or with the acquiescence of an official. So you see, it's not a crime that occurs between individuals. And so the issue of whether or not a sitting head of state has any kind of immunity, and as I say, that's only a defense and a temporary defense anyway, it's not a bar to prosecution, is a very, very important point, because if the president, if a sitting head of state has immunity from torture, well, then that means, first of all, that the rule of law is right out the window and the law doesn't apply equally to everybody. So then you have to say, okay, so where is the cutoff point? Is the cutoff point at the Secretary of Defense? Is the cutoff point at a general? Or are the only people we can prosecute are the people down below?
Well, unfortunately, the Bush administration has a now long history of conveniently ignoring domestic and foreign law as its needs demand, subject to its own interpretation. I mean, there's the entire issue of developing sort of the legal arguments here in the U.S. for why they viewed this as being okay. And one of the key people in designing this kind of pseudo-legal framework for where torture would be just fine to do is Alberto Gonzalez, the new nominee to become Attorney General after John Ashcroft slinked away. And, you know, there's the entire issue of, is the Bush administration, A, interested in considering international law as valid, kind of at a basic level? There's the Vienna Law of Treaties that the U.S. is party to. And then the U.S. Constitution, Article 6, Section 2, says all treaties are subject to the same level as the U.S. Constitution in terms of their applicability and force of law. So it's not like there's a gray area about these things, like even a little bit.
No, there isn't. No. Well, the what the U.S. administration has tried to do, and up until recently, they've been pretty successful. I guess a person could say they've been successful. They're still being successful insofar as they're getting away with it, is they've tried to create an area of lawlessness where there really essentially is no law. So with respect to the invasion of Afghanistan, the illegal invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, for instance, the U.S. administration said, well, we're developing a concept of preemptive strike. And, of course, that was a completely fanciful concept that has absolutely no legal authorization. It has no legitimacy whatsoever.
Although I have found something that is kind of just short of what the Bush administration views as preemptive strike. That is legally allowable, but you have to be able to demonstrate that, like, you're about to be attacked if you don't, kind of a thing.
This was a very far cry from both Iraq and Afghanistan. Never even came anywhere close to that.
Nope.
But, you see, there were a lot of sycophantic legal people at first who were willing to indulge in all kinds of really terrifying bafflegab, saying maybe it was all right to look for somebody in Afghanistan by carpet bombing the entire place. Then what happened right away, as soon as the Afghan invasion began, Mr. Bush delivered his November 2001 edict, where he said that the detainees would not be considered prisoners of war, and that's when he created the military tribunals, and they would be tried by these special tribunals.
But it was even before that, though. In just the first few weeks after the attacks of September 11th, where administration officials were talking about, you know, well, maybe we need to revisit the issue of how we do interrogations, and we might have to take a look at whether or not torture can be applied in certain limited circumstances.
Absolutely.
And this is like months and months before any public acknowledgement that Iraq was actually, you know, the goal here.
No, that's very true. That's very true. And then so what developed was this bizarre concept of that all of the, I think Mr. Gonzalez called international restraints on torture and other kinds of abuse, I think he termed them quaint, and they had to be set aside in order for the war on terror to be effective. And what was the treatment that was accorded to people and the way that the U.S. Armed Forces conducted themselves, so decreed Mr. Bush, Mr. Gonzalez, and Mr. Rumsfeld in a number of really chilling memos, was a concept that they made up called military necessity. So whatever was deemed to be militarily necessary from time to time. And, of course, there was no reference points to define what military necessity meant. And then the other little frightening catchword was legitimate government objective. So those two little things made a circle, which has resulted in a horrifying lawlessness on behalf of the U.S. Armed Forces in Iraq, in Guantanamo Bay, and in a host of other secret prisons around the world. So the issue, from the point of view of Lawyers Against the War, is terribly critical that countries start being forced by people like us and people like your listeners to aggressively enforce their national laws against torture. So, for instance, the U.S. has you have a War Crimes Act, as you know, in the U.S., which prohibits torture. And so, one of the things that all of these memos that flew around between the Department of Justice and Rumsfeld and Bush and so on, these fanciful memos, said that the president's edict, where he re-described people. He took their rights away by saying, just calling them something different. It was very Humpty Dumpty-ish. That would be a defense to the people that abused them. Well, of course, we see in the trials out of the people torturing and abusing people in Iraq that hasn't turned out to be a defense, and it never was a defense in national or international law. And the very interesting thing is that your own courts, the courts in the U.S., have now put the lie to all of those specious legal arguments that were made by the White House minions. A very important decision is the decision in the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the, you probably are well familiar with that one. That was a case where Mr. Hamdan is a detainee in Guantanamo Bay, and he was, his lawyer, his American lawyer, was bringing a habeas corpus petition saying that he couldn't be tried by the military, by Bush's military tribunal created by presidential order, because it violated the Geneva Convention's fair trial provisions. And, of course, the rejoinder from the U.S. administration was, oh, well, you're totally mistaken. The guy isn't a prisoner of war because we said he was something else.
Mm-hmm.
And the court naturally said that a prisoner of war is a prisoner of war, which is exactly what the Geneva Convention says, that where there's a dispute over whether or not a person is a prisoner of war, the person is deemed to be a prisoner of war until such time as a competent tribunal decides otherwise. And, of course, the military tribunal is not a competent tribunal and couldn't decide that issue anyway because it doesn't comply with Geneva Convention's requirements to be a competent tribunal.
You're listening to
people. So it's beginning to, the whole thing is beginning to crack and fall under the weight of decisions of American courts.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guest today is, well, for the first bit of the program, is Gail Davidson, who's co-chair of Lawyers Against the War. She filed an indictment against George W. Bush and some other folks last week regarding war crimes up in Canada, war crimes in Iraq, papers filed in Canada. You can find out more about them online at www.lawyersagainstthewar.org. You can see a copy of the indictment there, some letters that they've sent out to various government officials, and all that information is also at the People Rise Up website, where you can find that and links to other bits and pieces related to this, as well as what we'll be talking about in a little bit, which is a case against Donald Rumsfeld, George Tenet, and many, many others in Germany from a different group, although the timing is very similar. So we got about 10 more minutes to go here, Gail. The indictment was sort of, I guess, temporarily stopped. Y'all can do an appeal now of
that's
the
correct.
Rejection, so I assume you're going to.
Yes, that's correct.
And what would you like to have people here in the States do in support of this effort? I mean, even if there's no trial, conviction, etc., just getting the idea that these folks can and should be indicted for what are pretty obvious crimes, crimes against humanity, war crimes. What can folks do?
Well, thanks for asking that question, because it's really important what people do, because I think as a lawyer that law reform it doesn't come primarily from lawyers, it comes from people insisting that enough is enough. So a couple of things that your listeners can do, they could write to our Prime Minister and our Minister of Justice saying that you believe that the prosecution against Mr. Bush should go forward. And the other thing to do is to look into opportunities for enforcement of war crimes prosecutions in the United States. And
well, I thought that the reason that in part you in Canada and Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights in Germany were filing these charges in different countries is that I can't imagine anyone would honestly believe that these guys would actually have any sort of an opportunity to be prosecuted legally here in the States, given what the investigations have already looked like.
Well, the thing is, though, I don't think that anybody in the Bush administration ever anticipated the flood of evidence against them that is now completely in the public domain. I mean, all the memorandum, on the internet, the International Committee of the Red Cross reports, which are generally confidential. They've been leaked and are available. The government's own reports from the Taguba report, for instance, the Hetherington report, the evidence is overwhelming, so that really charges should be able to be brought in the United States.
Okay.
The evidence is all there.
And there's actually new news out this morning. This here is one Associated Press article out of Puerto Rico. U.S. Special Operations Forces accused of abusing prisoners in Iraq warned defense intelligence personnel not to talk about the alleged mistreatment they saw, according to a government memo to a top advisor of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. So, it seems like this continually is unraveling on them, and it's just a matter, it would seem, of a critical mass being reached and some judge somewhere just standing up and saying, okay, fine, you're right, we should be looking at this through the legal system, let's just do it.
Right, but in order for a judge to do that, because, of course, the judge can't do it on her own hook or his own hook, it takes people trying to properly lay those indictments, I should say. And so that's what I urge people to do. Our torture memos will be back up on our website by the weekend. That's another thing that your listeners can go to our website by, I should say, Sunday, and they'll be able to access our torture memos, which are a good reference point of where to go, where the evidence is, so that people don't have to put together all that evidence on their own.
And some of that's already on the People Rise Up website, and I'll be putting some more of those links together today so people can go back to that source material.
Right.
Now, you had mentioned to me yesterday, and I mentioned at the top of the hour, that you folks are going to become involved in the German case.
Yes, we are.
Against Secretary Rumsfeld, former DCI tenant, bunch of military folks, and
yes,
Pentagon civilian folks.
That's correct.
Can you just mention that as kind of a little bit movement towards a segue to Michael Ratner and the CCR?
Okay. Yes, we're Lawyers Against the War is just sending a letter to the German prosecutor advising him of who we are and asking that we be joined as plaintiffs in the German action. And then thereafter, of course, we'll have to take our lead from Michael Ratner and the CCR, but we're very much wanting to be a useful part of that. Lawyers Against the War, I just heard you in your intro. Lawyers Against the War is Canada-based, but we actually have members in 14 countries, so we're an international group, and we do have lawyers and law professors in Germany who are members of Lawyers Against the War. And the prosecution attempt in Germany, I think, is a very important one, and we're hoping that the German Attorney General, Chief Prosecutor, will have the courage to allow that prosecution to go ahead.
Well, the political pressure will be pretty intense should they get past that first initial hearing. And, you know, much like I'm sure political pressure weighed in on the judge's decision in BC Provincial Court Monday when he said, this doesn't exist.
That's right. It didn't happen.
the nullity, yeah, that's pretty bizarre.
Yes, and you know, one of the important things about the action in Canada and the action in Germany is that last fall I went on a little speaking tour in England, and the paper that I was presenting was called State Terrorism Prosecuting Tony Blair. And, you know, even amongst lawyers and peace activists, it was still a bit shocking for them to think of their prime minister in prison garb and behind bars. So part of what we as citizens have to do is we have to drag ourselves into the 21st century. It's a long way now from the Magna Carta, and say, yes, the law does apply. We want our law to apply equally to everybody. We don't want kings and presidents to be above the law. So that's part of what the whole issue is about, is saying, yes, the people that, the architects of these things, have to be held accountable.
Yeah, and here in the States, it was established about 32 years ago or so that, in fact, even the president is not above the law, and I'm referencing Richard Nixon here.
Yes.
And all his illegalities. And it was determined, yeah, that at that time, in fact, the equal protection under the law, part of the Constitution, in fact, does apply to the president and can be prosecuted just the same as everybody else when he breaks the law.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see that happen, because there's very, very little that, in fact, is legal in any sense of the Bush administration. So congratulations, Gail.
Thank you.
And
thank you for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll keep folks posted about developments in this and other cases along these lines. And again, lawyersagainstthewar.org for more information. Thank you very much for being on the show, Gail.
You're welcome. And give my congratulations to Michael Ratner when you speak to him.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Gail Davidson. She is the co-chair of Lawyers Against the War, a Canadian-based international coalition of lawyers who last week indicted George W. Bush on war crimes charges. The case is pending.